Hi, this is Susan St. James. Look out, here comes the Colonel.
Yes, yes, I know you don't think that's funny, but you didn't see what Susan St. James just did. All right, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get back to our interview with Michael B. Silovich, and he's got some interesting things to clarify for us for the last hour. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Also, a couple of news stories I'm going to want to pass along. Net neutrality is still in danger and a big advance in batteries. But first, let's step over here to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. Rummage around on the coin jar just a minute for today's query.
Well, to the fountain of useless information, how can I help
you? Aha, yes, we've thrown in the coins, and that means that we have awakened the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, here's one for you. The Atlas Mountains. They stretch eastward from Morocco and terminate near the capital of what other country? The Atlas Mountains, eastward from Morocco, terminate near the capital of what other country?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
Ah, we cannot stump the spirit of the fountain. The Atlas Mountains stretch eastward from Morocco and terminate near the capital of... If you said Sweden, you know nothing about geography. No, it's Tunisia. Tunisia, yes, of course. All right. Back to our program. Okay, so when we left Professor Michael Silovich in the first half hour, we were talking about how videos are used so much in security and that the example was used that in Boston, with the Boston Marathon bombing, the video didn't do anything to prevent the bombing, but it did cause us to solve the crime and figure out what it was. So there are limitations to video, and he was explaining why it's going to be increasingly important for the use of video.
You want to ask, are there overt events that you can detect with video cameras that will allow you to stop security breaches? So one example is when we leave the terminal of the airport, we go through secure area and we pass an exit door and we go into an unsecured area. Well, on occasion, there will be people that go the other way. They go from the unsecure area into the secure area, and they're able to do that without being detected or deterred. Well, if that happens, that creates a major, you can detect it, but you may be too late in stopping it, if you see what I'm saying. The person has already gone through and is in the secure terminal. You know that someone has breached the exit lane. You have to stop all activity until you can verify that the person that went the wrong way is harmless. And most of the time, those people are harmless. You know, oh my God, I left my laptop on the plane. So you turn around and you run back and try to get your laptop. Oh, where's my little three-year-old? Mm-hmm. He was right here a minute ago. And you turn around and you go back. But you can't assume that everything that happens like that is harmless. So it turns out that every time there is a breach of that type, it costs several million dollars in delays, in, you know, airplane stoppages until you can clear that breach. So that's an example of how we've used video to assist in the detection of the breaches in a way that allows them to be dealt with immediately. And so that poor mother that is looking for her three-year-old, we can help her, okay?
Mm, yeah.
But it's not going to shut down the airport.
Well, the other thing, too, is that you've got the video, and you have to have, you've got 40 million people, an exaggeration, of course, but I mean, you've got tons of people going through, and so I presume that the other challenge is to find some sort of automated way of being alerted that something just happened over here and we didn't catch it with our eye, and we got to go back and take a peek at that and see if that's something that should be considered a possible threat.
Yes. So video is normally used like that, like in the marathon bombing situation.
Yeah.
You use it in what's called the forensic mode. You know something has happened. You want to go and get some kind of a more detailed documentation of what happened and, you know, see what you can do about it. The marathon bombing is an excellent example of how video was a key technology in identifying the suicide, you know, the bombers, really. And in the same vein, what we're trying to do is in fact use video for forensics, just like other people do, but we want to make video an actionable technology.
Yes.
Something that, you know, when an anomalous event occurs, then we can act on it right away without having to go back and look forensically at what's happened. And that turns out to be a very challenging, but if you can do that, a very powerful technique.
Yeah, the Boston bombing, of course, was an excellent example of being able to identify the perpetrators and pinpoint the crime and exactly how it happened and how it went on and everything else, but it didn't do anything to prevent it. And what you're working on is the prevention, getting to it before the bomb can go off. Isn't that that's the case, right?
That's the actual challenge, is making the information actionable. So, you know, if you have information, it should be timely enough that you can actually act on it, as you say, to mitigate a potential threat.
Okay, now then, the guy sitting in the desert somewhere near Fallujah figuring out how they're going to get a bomb in one of our airplanes or something like that, and trying to get a very creative chemical weapon or something, could be anything. And a person is sitting in a state run laboratory. Let's say it could be, you know, Iran, or it could be North Korea, or it could be someplace else. And they're very sophisticated. Do you find that you're easier and you're concentrating on the simple threat of the simple guy who's using drugstore substances to make this threat because he's got no access to things sophisticated there in the desert? Or do you also have to look at or find a big difference, let's say, more challenging difference from the state-sponsored possibilities of terrorism?
Well, you know, I think that's really something that we need. We collaborate with Homeland Security, and they brief our center on things that we should be on the lookout for. So, you know, the more we can be effective and relevant, you know, the better off we can serve Homeland Security. But on the other hand, you know, a lot of the techniques that we use are fundamental. You know, explosives, whether they're the traditional ones or, God help us, the new ones that are emerging, you know, every day, they're chemicals and they have composition, and the techniques that we use to characterize and detect trace signatures of these materials, you know, once you can identify what materials you're looking for, in a sense, the same technology can be tuned to identify the new types of threats. But, you know, this is an area where, you know, there's a lot of sensitive information, and I really don't want to talk about it anymore.
I understand that, of course, and we don't want to get sensitive or to try to uncover things. And that's good, and I appreciate that. And I think you know that's the point of this program too, to inform as much as we can, but not give away any state secrets or anything that's going to harm us. I have, though, however, been under the impression up until now that there are a limited number of explosive materials out there, and once you've identified what those are, that you can pretty well devise ways of protecting it. But you're leading me to believe that there's new. You say new things coming around all the time. So are you saying that the future holds continuous challenges and we may never really ever identify all the explosive materials that can be devised?
Well, you know, I hope that's not the case. I'm not willing to say yes or no.
Mm.
But, you know, right now I do know that, you know, we're dealing with a very agile adversary, and you know, the more effectively we can understand the different, you know, measures and countermeasures, the more effective we'll be. I think that you know, the horizon is not well defined at this point, Colonel.
Well, you're going to have a fascinating tutorial at the Homeland Security Technology Conference that IEEE is hosting in Boston in the middle of April, and we're really going to look forward to seeing you there and hearing what you have to say. And I wonder if, before we get out of here, if you can maybe give us a peek into the future, looking down the road 5 years or 10 years, where do you see this all going? Can you give us a view?
Well, I think that one view is the so-called checkpoint of the future. And we're working, you know, along with industry, along with the Department of Homeland Security, to really, you know, make the screening process as seamless and as, you know, transparent to most of the passengers. I mean, most of us, you know, are legitimate passengers. We want to just go from point A to point B. And we don't want to stand in line. We don't want to have a lot of delays. We'd like to be able to, you know, effectively go in the entry level of the airport and, you know, 10 minutes later be at the gate. So that's the goal, at least in terms of passenger screening. You know, there are other long-term goals in terms of crowd screening, you know, for detecting suicide bombers in, you know, venues such as shopping malls and sports arenas, and they present their technology challenges just like the airport screening technology challenges are pretty well defined. So in summary, what I'd like to say is we want to be as effective in detecting threats as we possibly can. We want to work hand in hand with industry, with university partners, with the Department of Homeland Security, with the, you know, collaborating nations as a whole, to really combat what I see as, you know, the major terrorist incursions that we're dealing with now as, you know, part of our life.
All right, and that's going to be the takeaway, I guess, when we hear your tutorial in Boston at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference, the middle of April. Before we finally say goodbye, Michael, I wonder if you, just on a personal note, if you had maybe a word of wisdom.
Think simply, you know. Think, you know. Let your ideas be big picture ideas, and that can be articulated crisply and concisely and simply to the person in the street. And if you can send that kind of an effective message to someone that isn't an expert in your field, and they say, wow, I get it, okay, then chances are you've got something that's worth exploring and developing into, you know, a major project. That's been kind of the watchword that I've, you know, used for myself throughout my career.
Well, Professor Selovich, you've been a generous, very, 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 very generous with your time and highly informative, and I've so enjoyed having you on the program, and we'll look forward to seeing you at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in Boston in the middle of April. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Colonel, and look forward to meeting you in person.
Absolutely. And a couple of things of note, of course, we learned last week that finally we got that resounding victory that we wanted in the battle for an open Internet. We heard last Thursday that the FCC voted on and passed the strongest ever net neutrality protection to make sure that, of course, our Internet that we all know and love won't be sold to the highest bidder. And it was a milestone moment. Of course, we celebrated. We've been fighting this battle for a long time, but we can't stop now. Congress is still trying to strip the FCC of its powers by voting on and advancing that Thune-Upton bill that they've got sitting around there. They succeed, it'll roll back our victory and snatch real net neutrality right from underneath our noses. So this is one of the most important free speech issues of the digital age, I believe, anyway, and winning net neutrality is really, really a big deal. So many people rallied around it. Over 4 million Americans told us told the FCC that net neutrality is critical to internet freedom. And thanks to the chairman and their commissioners, Clyburn and Rosenwalsall, for voting to protect the internet, and we really appreciate all their work. But it won't matter if Congress interferes with the FCC's ability to do the job and call the shots on net neutrality, so they could still ruin this big for us. We might want to get a hold of our congressman and express our desires to them to throw out the Thune-Upton bill. That would be my recommendation. And here's an interesting story that it came through from R&D Magazine about efforts of boosting carbon stability for better lithium air batteries to power cars so they can travel hundreds of miles at a time. And this article says that lithium ion batteries of the future are going to have to hold more energy without growing too big in size. I guess that's one of the dilemmas confronting their efforts to power cars through rechargeable battery technology. In order to hold enough energy for a trip of, let's say, 300 to 500 miles before recharging, the current lithium ion batteries become too big and too expensive. There's been a lot of talk on this program that we've discussed many times about the future for battery-operated cars is pretty dim, because batteries have to be so totally self-contained. Internal combustion engines, like you and me, are an internal combustion engine. I mean, we breathe air, we take in hydrocarbons, and the mixture of the air and the hydrocarbons in our body, and we move, and it seems all creation is an internal combustion engine. But a battery-operated car, of course, is going to be totally self-contained. And the worry, too, is about when the weather gets really cold. So there's a search for the post-lithium ion battery is being waged. It's been developing materials that might one day enable the manufacture of new batteries capable of meeting power demands within the size and cost constraints of car makers and other industries. So this story in R&D Magazine is pretty fascinating to us. In a recent report published, Professor Duy Wang and his colleagues from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst have unveiled a new method of stabilizing carbon, they say. And, of course, carbon is a central structure component of any battery. And they say that they could pave the way for new performance standards in the hunt for the lithium ion components. Central to the search, this story says, for improved performance is the ability to shed weight and costly chemical components, it says here. Researchers pursuing a lithium air battery, not lithium ion, but lithium air battery, have focused on a chemical reaction of lithium and oxygen, which can be pulled from the air. And that would then solve the internal combustion dilemma that we have with the batteries. But the only problem is the materials used to generate the reaction have shown poor life cycles, only lasting through just a few charges. But Wang says he thinks he's found the culprit. He said it's the instability of carbon, that essential structural support to a battery's electrodes. Carbon is used, he said, this is a quote, carbon is used in every battery because it has the combination of low cost, lightweight, and conductivity, says Wang. And you can't just scrap it, close quote. So Wang and the University of Massachusetts Assistant Professor of Chemical Engineering, Wai Fang, have set to work for improving the performance capabilities of a newly engineered form of carbon fabricated by Fan. And it's called three-dimensionally ordered monoporous carbon. And scientists value it for its highly ordered structure. So I guess we're going to see what happens. If we can get a lithium ion battery that will use air, and it doesn't have to be totally self-contained, so it can act such as an internal combustion engine might act. This may solve the problem, because there's a lot of people that view, you know, battery-operated cars as not having a particularly good future. But Wang said the findings show the carbon can meet new performance standards when it is stabilized. This new carbon, it calls it 3DOM carbon. And he says, as a quote, the key innovation we make here is that 3DOM, I think that would be 3DOM, carbon is stable, and we have stabilized something that was not previously stable. So I guess we're going to keep a close watch on this and see what happens in the future of battery-operated cars. I just thought it was pretty fascinating that I passed that on to you. And then here's another a pretty exciting story that came in from R&D. Scientists at the University of Luxembourg and the Japanese electronics company TDK, remember them, report progress in photovoltaic research. They've improved a component that will enable solar cells to use more energy of the sun, and so then create, of course, a higher current. Now, as we know, China has about got the corner on photovoltaic, so this is really interesting that the Japanese have teamed up with the University of Luxembourg. And this improvement concerns a conductive oxide film, which now has more transparency in the infrared region. You know, there's been many attempts been made before, but they say is the first time these films were prepared by a one-step process and at the same time stable in air. Transparent conductive oxides are used in all sorts of devices that combine electronics and light, as we well know, like LEDs, solar cells, photo detectors, even the touch screens. They have the particularity to combine the properties of metals, which, of course, are the best electrical conductors known, with those of oxides, which usually are transparent and not conductive at all, for example, glass. In solar cells, the film has to be conductive because it constitutes the upper electrode. And at the same time, it has to be transparent in order to sunlight, of course, to reach the layer underneath where the current is formed. The oxide forming this film can be made conductive by deliberately adding impurities like zinc oxide with aluminum added in a widely used example. In this case, the aluminum adds free electrons to the zinc oxide, which are responsible for the conductivity. However, they say these free electrons also absorb infrared light, and that means less sun energy can pass through. So the team at Luxembourg and TDK have modified the process used to make the film in order to make sure that pure zinc oxide is more conductive. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Get your hands dirty. Get into utilizing tools and understanding data. Certainly be safe with what you're doing in terms of your own exploration of these tools, because you can certainly get in a lot of trouble. But start to work with data, start to work with these different tools to better your understanding of how they work in the real world. I'm Nick Jacoby. I'm a research associate and lecturer in the College of Information Sciences and Technology, and I teach and do research in cybersecurity.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.